Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amon 4. Here's what's coming up.
Honestly, it's shocking, you know, that she's missing.
Where is Peng Shuang? The Chinese tennis star has not been seen since making assault allegations against a former Communist Party leader. We discuss what her fate says about China. And
we're not sure exactly what Mr. Putin is up to.
Russia is building up its forces on Ukraine's eastern border. What could happen next with top Russia expert Andrew Weiss? Then, as U.S. drug deaths hit a record high, I speak to Nikki King, who is pioneering new ways to fight the opioid epidemic. Plus, actor John Cho talks to Hari Srinivasan about bringing super stylish anime Cowboy Bebop to life.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Bianca Golodriga in New York, sitting in for Christiane Amanpour, who will be back next week. The Chinese tennis star Peng Shuai has not been seen since November 2nd. That's when she posted comments accusing a former Chinese vice premier of coercing her into having sex. Well, now new fears have been sparked by an email to the Women's Tennis Association, purportedly from Peng Shuai herself. It walks back all previous accusations. The head of the WTA is now casting doubt on this email, saying it only further raises concerns for Shuai's safety. So what has happened to her, and what does her disappearance say about China? Joining me now on this is former tennis pro Pam Shriver. Just like Peng Shuai, she was a doubles champion during her career. And also with us is James Miles, China editor for The Economist. Welcome, both of you. Pam, let me begin with you just to give our audience a sense of Peng as a player and what she was known for as a doubles champion.
Yes, she won a couple of majors, actually playing alongside Shea Sui, who's from Chinese Taipei. And she also got the semifinals of the U.S. Open about 6 years ago. So she was considered a top singles and doubles player. She last played just before the start of the pandemic, but had not officially retired. And so it's obviously of great concern to all of us in the tennis world, both current players and retired players like myself, as well as, of course, the entire organization of the WTA Tour.
And James, clearly she is a well-known player within the tennis community and tennis world, but I would assume within China itself specifically. And we can't talk about her disappearance without talking about the accusation, the shocking accusation that she leveled before the disappearance. And that was the country's first real Me Too accusation, and one where she accused a high-level government official at that. What was the initial response following that accusation that we should note was quickly taken down off of social media within minutes?
Well, she, of course, is now purportedly through this email to the WTA denying all of this and distancing herself from what appeared on her verified Weibo account on November the 2nd. But the message on that account, which was a long one, detailed allegations against Zhang Gaoli, a former deputy prime minister, a former member of the Politburo Standing Committee. That's a group of the most powerful seven men in China, describing an on-again, off-again relationship over a number of years, but at some point forced sexual advances by Mr. Zhang. There's been no response from him to this. The authorities have not commented directly on these allegations, and there's simply no way of verifying whether indeed it's the case, as is now purportedly the case, that Peng Shuai is absolutely fine, resting at home, or whether indeed she is now under huge pressure from the authorities to keep quiet, and this this message has been forced out of her.
And so Pam, leading to the initial message that she posted with the accusation, you know, the post disappeared and then she disappeared. And I would imagine that China, being a repressive regime, would have imagined that this is the case closed. Had it not been for management's response from the Women's Tennis Association, and specifically from its chief executive, who in response to her initial allegations added that there needed to be a thorough investigation and said, if at the end of the day we don't see the appropriate results from this, we would be prepared to take that step and not operate our business in China if that's what it came to. It's rare that we see this kind of a direct threat from the chief executive of companies that do business in China. How big of an impact do you think this had throughout this crisis?
Well, Steve Simon, who is the CEO, the current CEO, has definitely come out with some very strong statements. As head of one of the leading sports organizations in the world and the leading professional sport for women, WTA, he has to do this. It's a tough one. There's 11 WTA tour events scheduled to be in China, and obviously they've been on hold because of the pandemic, but they have more WTA tour events than any other country. That wasn't the case 20 years ago. So they've been a rapid business partner that's been growing, but at a certain point, you can't have one of your players or future players, their safety be in doubt. And what the WTA stands for is equality and freedom for women to express what has happened to them. And it's going to put the WTA obviously in a tough position, but I think true to the values of the original nine that Billie Jean King helped found, the reason why women's tennis has been a brave organization for years will give Steve Simon and the WTA right now in this situation, I think, a lot of motivation to do the right thing.
And perhaps it was his initial response that led to what we now have heard overnight, purportedly from Peng herself, in an email that the WTA received. Let me read what the email says. In part, it reads, "The news in that release from the WTA, including the allegation of sexual assault, is not true. I'm not missing, nor am I unsafe. I'm just resting at home, and everything is fine." Now, to that, WTA Chairman Steve Simon responds, "I have a hard time believing that Peng Shuai actually wrote the email we received or believes what is being attributed to her." Now, we should note that CNN cannot independently verify this post and has reached out to both Peng and the China State Council, and we have yet to receive a response from them. But James, where do things go now? What is the next step? We have this purported email, which the WTA says sounds suspicious.
Well, you've got to bear in mind that this is the first allegation of this kind that has come out against a senior politician at this kind of level. So the authorities will be trying as hard as they can to cover this up. This was a man, Zhang Gaoli, who held enormous power during the first 5 years of Xi Jinping's rule. He was at the center of much of the most important decision-making in China about economic matters, about the Belt and Road Initiative, that's the global infrastructure building project. And this is not a time in China when, I mean, there never is, but this time in particular is not a time when the authorities, want these kind of allegations coming out in public. It's a tense time politically, building up to the Communist Party's 20th Congress at the end of next year, at which Xi Jinping is expected to be endorsed for another five-year term as General Secretary of the party. And there's a lot of politics surrounding that. He doesn't have any obvious opposition within China, but there are certainly many people who grumble about his rule in private, many people with misgivings, not least about his campaigning against corruption, which has taken down many thousands, tens of thousands of officials. And so, you know, they will be trying to make sure that this is completely silenced. And indeed, they've been eradicating it from social media. You can't find the name now of Peng Shuai. If you search for it online, all that comes up is stories dating back to last year. If you try posting messages containing her name, they are deleted by censors. And indeed, there was a time, at least briefly, after this news first broke in early November, when even the word tennis became a sensitive one on social media, and censors were trying to stop that term circulating.
So this, Pam, this may be the first time that one of these types of accusations is leveled against a high-ranking official, but it's not the first time that a well-known figure within China has just disappeared. I mean, we talk a lot about where Jack Ma is these days. There was a film actress who, for a time, was not heard from as well. And I guess this leads to the question, I guess, the fine line that business leaders and corporations, the WTA, one of them, has to walk about doing business within China when you know that these types of events are taking place, when human rights is front and center, and the authoritarian regime just seems to be getting harder and harder.
Well, when you consider the role of sports in China in recent years, from hosting the 2008 Summer Olympic Games, and just in a couple of months, they're supposed to be welcoming athletes, men and women, from all over the world. If I was the IOC right now, I would be really concerned. And if I was a female athlete or coming from some part of the world into China, I would have a lot of doubts, unless I know that Peng Shuai is safe and freely going about her business as a WTA tennis player.
Well, we do know, Pam, we have heard from Naomi Osaka, we heard from Billie Jean King, Chris Evert, others have spoken out and talked about their concerns and voiced their concerns about where Peng Shuai is now. But it is still rare and a bit taboo. Look at what happened with the NBA, case in point. They have a huge investment in relationship with China. And Enes Kanter happened to be on this program recently and addressed this and speaking out about human rights issues around the world that are highlighted, except for perhaps China. And let's play that clip for you to respond to.
You see, there is so many athletes, so many actors, so many singers, and so many people who has a platform are speaking out many of the issues out there in the world. But when it comes to China, when it comes to, you know, China's Communist Party, they're scared because they care too much about money, they care too much about business, and they care too much about endorsement deals.
So is that hypocritical? I mean, is he right? And is it right then for China not to view this as a major threat, given what he just said?
Well, when the news broke a couple of days ago, I was actually working live for the Tennis Channel because the women's tennis tour just finished their year-end championships last night in Guadalajara that was moved from Shenzhen, China, because it couldn't take place last year and they needed to have these tour championships. And I did some calling around to see, as a tennis commentator crossing over in sort of to the news media side of things with a little bit of a journalistic look at it. And I was certainly told by people in the know that I needed to be pretty careful if I wanted to do business in China, go back to China as an ambassador for tennis, that, you know, if I said things that were a little too strong, that probably was not going to happen again. Well, I already played once in Beijing back in 94, that first time they ever had a women's professional tournament. It's not a big part of my life, but obviously it's a concern. But in the end, I think all of us in the world of tennis, the thing that we want most is to know that Peng is free and healthy and able to go out and practice tennis if she wants. We want to see her and not see an email that, as Steve Simon correctly analyzes, does not seem like it's coming from Peng Shuai.
And wow, 1994 Beijing is quite different from 2021 and 22 Beijing. And that makes me lead to the next question, James, about what the U.S. should do, because there are reports that the administration is considering a diplomatic boycott and not sending administration heads and figureheads and politicians perhaps to the game, but it's still allowing athletes to go and not punish them. Do you think that is a measured enough response? Would that be the correct decision by the U.S. government?
Well, first of all, it may be a moot point. It's not entirely clear whether China is yet welcoming foreign leaders to come to Beijing. It has, of course, announced very strict measures, quarantine-related measures, in order to prevent imported infections of COVID-19 during the event. So there will be a bubble, if you like, around the games. That will mean that athletes are kept within it. There'll be long periods of quarantine surrounding that. And it'll be very difficult, I think, were they to invite large numbers of foreign leaders in, how to handle that from a quarantine point of view. And you have to bear in mind that Xi Jinping himself, of course, has just had this online virtual summit with Joe Biden. That was an indication, many months after Mr. Biden took office. This was the first such in-vision meeting between the two men, and it was held online. So it's not entirely clear that they want people to be there in person. And of course, they're very mindful that were they to invite a lot of foreign leaders, questions of boycotts would come up and be very embarrassing for them. They are not inviting in spectators from outside the country, just mm-hmm. as the Japanese didn't at the Tokyo Summer Olympics. So this right. is something that remains to be seen.
Well, and it is telling that in the three-hour meeting, virtual meeting, reportedly the Olympics did not come up and an invitation was not extended from President Xi to President Biden. Obviously, the most important point here is finding and making sure that Peng Shuai is okay and her well-being is the primary order here. So we'll continue to follow this story. Thank you so much, Pam and James. We appreciate your time. Well, from China to neighboring Russia, where President Vladimir Putin is gathering Russian forces on the eastern border of Ukraine. That's stoking fears of a potential military escalation in the region. The Ukraine issue is personal for Mr. Putin. A recent report from the Carnegie Endowment saying there is little doubt that Ukraine is the single most important piece of unfinished business as the Russian leader contemplates his agenda. Well, earlier today, I spoke with one of the authors of that report, Andrew Weiss. He oversees research for Carnegie on Russia and Eurasia. And he told me what he thinks is Russia's goal. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us. As we know, Russia has once again amassed tens of thousands of troops along its border with Ukraine. And that has many experts, yourself included, worrying about a possible incursion similar to the one that we saw in 2014 when Russia annexed Crimea. Why are you so worried this time in particular?
I think the real reason people are worried is that this is the single most important piece of unfinished business on Vladimir Putin's record. If he looks back over his more than 20 years in power, he's obviously done a lot to make Russia great again in his eyes. But what he has not done is kept a hold of Ukraine. In fact, he's lost Ukraine twice. So what I think a lot of policymakers around the world are worrying about is whether this time it's different, and whether he is really intending to change in a fundamental way Ukraine's orientation and to basically show that it has to come back into the Russian fold.
Well, listen, it definitely has got the attention of world leaders. And in the U.S. as well, Secretary of State Blinken had warned that Russia may be laying a trap for Ukraine to respond and thus view that as a provocation to once again invade the country. But we saw something similar from Russia amassing troops earlier this year in the spring, and that dissipated. So why do you think this time is different?
Well, back in the spring, the signal that I think the Russians were focused on was they had a new U.S. administration, and they were really worried that the Biden team was gearing up for sort of a full court press on Russia. And they used the military buildup back then to serve a couple purposes. One was to show that you can't trifle with Russia, that Russia has the ability to punch back, especially in places like Ukraine, where it has potentially the upper hand and certainly geographic proximity on its side. But then it also got Putin what he wanted, which was a one-on-one meeting with Joe Biden in Geneva. Now the situation looks a little different. What the Russians are indicating is that they are really worried that the United States and our NATO allies are basically using Ukraine as a platform for conducting military activities for basically the foreseeable future. It's an open-ended set of activities that over time, any Russian leader who's thinking about his legacy is not going to be very comfortable bequeathing to their successor. So in some ways, Ukraine is looking more and more, if you're sitting on the Russian side of the table, like an aircraft carrier that's parked just off the coast of Russia.
Yeah, and using that imagery, it was just today that Vladimir Putin said that, that NATO bombers that are flying near the border are, quote, crossing red lines. But it's not just the Ukraine issue in particular that has Western leaders concerned. Obviously, we've been spending a lot of time focusing on what's happening in Belarus and its border with Poland and the migrants that are caught in between there. Obviously, Russia and Putin has played a conduit here in relations between Lukashenko and Western leaders, including Angela Merkel. I want to play for you sound of what the Ukrainian foreign minister said about this and how it relates to the conflict at its own borders with CNN earlier this week.
This moment seems to be extremely tense, not only because of the military buildup of Russia along our border, but also because other element of this crisis that we're observing in Europe, when Russia uses gas as a weapon, migrants as a weapon, and is bringing more weapons to the border with Ukraine.
So clearly Ukraine is sending a message that it, too, is worried. And I'm wondering, going back to what Blinken had warned, that could be a possible provocation that Russia uses as a sign from Ukraine to invade. How are Ukrainians and how is the government responding to the provocation that we're seeing there on the border? And do you think they're handling it appropriately?
Well, people are sounding the alarm and they're doing what you would expect them to do, both the Ukrainian government and their Western partners, which is they're indicating what they're seeing, and they're basically forcing the Russians now, who've kept their activities largely clandestine, to respond. And the Russian response is basically to say, yeah, we're upset and we've got all these concerns. Some of their concerns are longstanding, some of them are new. So the idea that the West shouldn't be cooperating with Ukraine in the military area, that's basically a new demand. And the question will be, is any U.S. president willing to go there? I suspect not. The other issue, which you have to accept, is that the Russians use activities to throw the West off balance. And they like using the element of surprise, and they like using escalation as a way of testing Western resolve and seeing whether we back off. And oftentimes, largely because Russia is a formidable country armed with nuclear weapons, no one has an interest in pushing the confrontation button on their desk. People want to be really careful not to overcommit and not to mismatch what our real capability or what our real commitments are. And you know, if you go back just a few years, President Obama said very publicly that it appears that Vladimir Putin cares more about Ukraine than we do, and the United States is not prepared to go to war. I'm not sure anything has changed.
Yeah. And that leads me to ask about your latest piece with your colleague, Eugene Rumer, where you call Ukraine Putin's unfinished business. Why is Putin so obsessed and focused on Ukraine in particular, as opposed to other former Soviet republics that are now too independent?
Ukraine is special. It's the largest and most important of the post-Soviet successor states. It is located in a very strategic position between Russia and Europe. It has been a place that is connected in many ways to Putin on a metaphysical and emotional level. And given the black eye he got from popular revolutions in Ukraine in 2004 and then again in 2014, this is the place that basically feels like it's totally slipping away and that wants to be on a decisive path westward. Putin can't abide that, and he's written publicly and said publicly multiple times that he will not allow it, basically over my dead body. And because of the concern that he means business, and because he has a lot of tools at his disposal to make Ukraine take him seriously and make the West take him seriously, I think, once again, we need to listen to what Putin is saying, and we need to take it very seriously. We shouldn't act as if this is a person who's obviously just bluffing or who's trying to basically jawbone the Ukrainians into making a few modest adjustments in their foreign policy. And that's why people are so worried.
And that leads to the question of whether Putin right now is a rational thinker, because on the one hand, he wouldn't be in power for this long if he wasn't. That having been said, you talk in this piece about his longtime obsession with Ukraine. But one also has to think back to the consequences following the annexation of Crimea. Sure, he was popular back home for a while, but that led to unlimited number of sanctions against Russia by Western leaders. The country is still ostracized based upon that incursion. Why wouldn't he learn lessons from that as opposed to doubling down and wanting to continue that mission?
It's a great question. And we have a split screen. On the one hand, you're right, the Russians are pretty good at calculating and spotting our weak points and exploiting them. They know that the United States is not prepared to go to war in Ukraine. They also know that after 2014, the West basically took its best shot at Russia in terms of sanctions and other steps. And the Russians have sort of lived to absorb those blows and keep on going. At the same time, there's a side of Vladimir Putin going back to his earliest, you know, childhood when he was basically a street tough on the streets of Leningrad in the 1960s, who is pretty emotional and who can do things and sort of lash out in ways that don't necessarily make sense to us. And so if you look at the situation now, he's indicating very clearly that the idea that Ukraine as a Western military partner is a threat to Russia and something that's unacceptable to him, a red line, that he may mean business.
How would you rate or analyze the Biden administration's approach toward Vladimir Putin and Russia, in particular to the Ukraine issue? We know that CIA Director Bill Burns had a rather unusual meeting with Vladimir Putin just a few weeks ago. Obviously, there's a history there. He had been U.S. ambassador to Russia. He knows the Russians quite well. Would you say that Biden and his administration are approaching and dealing with Russia in a way that you think is constructive?
Absolutely. These are all very experienced people, starting with President Biden and on through the core members of the National Security Team, who understand Russia and who understand what they're dealing with. There's no question at the same time that they would much rather have the Russia problem basically be in a box and be stable and not, you know, a major distraction as they retool the U.S. national security apparatus to gear up for a long-term challenge, which is China. And Vladimir Putin is, I think, once again, doing a great job of showing he knows how to jerk our chain, he knows how to get attention, and he knows how to throw people in the West off balance. And finding the right balance on the U.S. side of resolve and commitment without doing things that are, you know, that it would be needlessly provocative, that's where the Biden team, I think, is particularly focused, as well as building a strong multilateral response to the Russians so that they see how isolated they are and so that they begin to frame in their own minds some of the downsides, whether it's economic sanctions, international isolation. And then let's not forget, the people of Ukraine have made a decisive move westward, and they are prepared to fight and die for their country.
Yeah, it does make me think of whether or not you can compare how Putin views Ukraine with how President Xi of China views Taiwan, right? But we will have to end it there. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us. It is a fascinating piece, and I know you will be continuing to watch the space very closely. We appreciate your time.
Great to be here. Thank you so much.
Now to a domestic crisis for Americans. There were a record 100,000 deaths from drug overdoses during the 12 months ending in April. Just let that number sink in, 100,000. It's a huge number driven by opioids, which caused nearly two-thirds of those deaths. My next guest has seen the toll of the U.S. opioid epidemic up close. Born in small-town Kentucky, Nikki King left home at 18, determined to make a better life for herself and help her community, which had been hit hard by the drug epidemic. Now she is a senior leader at Zinnia Health, and she heads up treatment programs nationally for at-risk individuals. Nikki King joins me now from Rhode Island. Nikki, I know that you are an optimist here, so I don't want to have such a dour start to our conversation, but just to let those numbers sink in for our viewers, numbers that you are well aware of, 275 people died a day. 100,000 deaths is higher than the toll of car crashes and gun fatalities combined. You see this on a daily basis. You've seen it for many, many years. What is your response to it, and how did we get here?
Well, honestly, I think to the question of how we got here, I think you have to look back. You know, I think that, you know, we talk about the drug epidemic like it's new, like this has just been a thing for the last 10 years. When anybody can tell you, you know, inner city communities, minority communities were struggling with this for years before it got public attention. And I think what you're really looking at is you're looking at a very long and protracted trauma response. And you're looking at a lot of untreated mental illness and people that we were really willing to shove under the rug as a company or as a country for a long, long time. And how that ultimately evolved into, you know, a substance use epidemic, which has obviously really come to a head during the pandemic. You know, my response to it is, yeah, you know, I mean, I'm not going to act like that. That's not a gut punch. Like that doesn't, it doesn't make you feel like, you know, you're not doing enough or nothing's ever enough. But yeah, we've been heading this way for a long time.
You've had your wake-up call on this. You've lived a wake-up call, given what you've experienced with your family, friends, your childhood, and what you deal with on a daily basis, that's for sure. I wanted to ask you, because you touched on the pandemic, and look, this has been an uphill battle, something that was a major talking point that needed to be discussed as a country during the 2016 election. Everyone from both sides of the aisle seems to be aware that this is a crisis. But then again, you add on a pandemic and everything shuts down and people are isolated. They lose their jobs. They can't go to the hospital. They are home alone. And that seems like it was a recipe for disaster for those who were already struggling with opioid addiction.
Yeah. You know, I think I didn't expect it to get better during the pandemic. What I was somewhat shocked to see is how many people who were rock solid and sustained recovery, people that I personally felt like would never return to use. I really feel like the vast majority of people that I know who had been, you know, living drug-free lifestyles for years were kind of forced back into their old coping mechanism. And it's devastating. You know, you do all this work and you see people turn their lives around. Anybody who works in treatment can tell you the difference between the day that somebody enters treatment and the day they leave is just like life has just been breathed back into them, you know, and it's so hard to watch that fall apart. It's so hard to just watch it crumble, especially in the face of, you know, we're asking more and more of our healthcare workers every single day, and you just see it come to less and less fruition. But to your point about me being an optimist, something that I've been thinking about through all of this as well is, you know, as you mentioned, the social isolation, things shutting down, and the effect that had on causing this huge, unprecedented uptick in substance use disorder deaths. I think that it bodes really well for the future in a weird sort of way, because think about it, if we are so interconnected that taking us and putting our society into isolation has really created this big of an uptick, what could we do if we reverse that? You know, if we really pulled together as a community, as you mentioned, reaching across both sides of the aisle, if we really pulled together and did like the opposite of the pandemic, what would that do towards fixing it? Because look what a huge effect that had. So.
Well, look, I think just given your work in treatment and a new approach that you have brought to experts in the community who initially were a bit skeptical about the medical assisted treatment that you have prescribed and you have seen work. Talk about that and why it was a struggle to convince those who are well-meaning to help addicts overcome their addiction, do it with medication.
So, you know, I would say back in the 90s, there was really a big push in medicine that pain is the fifth vital sign and that we're really not doing enough to treat pain and chronic pain. And, you know, frankly, there's some truth to that. And I would argue today, in a way, we're not doing enough to treat chronic pain. You know, we, at the time, you know, with OxyContin and everything else, there was a full court press on doctors to prescribe more and more and more, and they did. And it set loose a wildfire. And now we've swung so hard back the other way that people who have, who really, really need chronic pain management in order to live their lives, now they can't get the treatment. And we still have overprescribers. And so I think that it's unfortunately, you know, the doctors heard for so long, you're a terrible doctor, you're not controlling your patient's pain, you're giving them poor quality of care, and you don't care about them. And so then they controlled the pain, and then it's, well, you made everybody addicted. Look how many hundreds of thousands of people you've killed. Don't you feel any shame about prescribing OxyContin? And now the doctors are like, okay, I'll stop prescribing. And now they're like, well, why aren't you prescribing MAT? And to them, you know, they see the narcotic component, and that makes them very nervous.
MAT is the medication-assisted treatment, and just to give our viewers a sense of the results, after a year of you working with patients with medical-assisted treatment, 45 had completed the 8-month program with no issue, 18 had relapsed once, 8 of whom re-engaged immediately in treatment, no one had an overdose. In fact, you write, one participant had used a Narcan kit from CATS, this is the program, the Courts Addiction and Drug Services program, to resuscitate a relative. So technically you said we're at a plus one. This does seem to work. Are you getting positive reception from other experts across the country?
Yeah, you know, really what we did in that treatment program and have since replicated multiple times, it's not really anything that we didn't know. It's just pulling together a lot of pieces and getting a lot of community buy-in. And, you know, it kind of goes to what I was saying with the pandemic. You know, one of the biggest success factors that we had was really pulling in the criminal justice folks and helping them see across the aisle. I think that it gets really easy for people on the treatment side to completely criminalize the criminal justice side in our minds, and it gets really easy for the criminal justice people to completely write off the treatment people as being bleeding hearts who aren't tough enough on crime. And, you know, the truth of the matter is that we've shown that it takes everyone. It takes those communities working together. It takes the faith communities working together. It takes the prescribers working together with the therapists. And we build that community. And when we build the community, we see the results. Just like when we lost that community during the pandemic, we saw those results.
Well, Nikki King, thank you so much for your compassion and your dedication to this issue. And it's something that has raised awareness across the country. Too many lives have been lost, and your approach to view this as a disease, as opposed to blaming those who are suffering through it, is really game-changing, I think. Thank you for that and for your optimism. We appreciate it.
Yeah, no, thank you. And, you know, I would say to people who see it as a disease, it just doesn't help. We've done that. It's not working. Try something new.
Yeah, try something new. Nikki, thank you. Well, one of the most influential anime series of all time has been given the live-action Netflix treatment, and it's out this Friday. Cowboy Bebop is an action-packed Western set in space decades from now. It stars John Cho, best known for roles in Harold and Kumar and Star Trek. At a time when Hollywood is talking about diversity more than ever, Cho sat down with Hari Srinivasan to discuss his journey as an actor and what it means to be part of such a well-loved project.
Thanks, Bianca. John Cho, thanks for joining us. So for someone who's not familiar with the anime or with the Netflix version yet, what is Cowboy Bebop? Because it's a bit genre-bending.
It is. That was certainly the attraction for me, but it is a kind of a mixture of film noir, westerns, comedy, action, all blended into this big soup. It's set in the future in 2071, and humans have left Earth because it's become uninhabitable. Sound familiar? and we play bounty hunters who are... you know, we're vigilantes taking in people, making a couple extra bucks, trying to taking criminals for the cops.
Okay, I want to play a clip here. This is, well, this will be pretty self-explanatory when we take a look.
Ah! dump now?
We ain't got all day.
Hello? Spike. Hello?
We'll get to the crazy physicality in a second, but one of the things that you notice right away, the bebop in the name, I mean, that is not the music that you expect in the middle of kind of a martial arts fight scene. It's really part of the show.
Yes, I will give all credit to our composer, Yoko Kanno, who was a composer for the original series, and we managed to lure her back for our show. And she's very idiosyncratic. She makes choices that are really unconventional at every turn. And I would argue she kind of, the choices are so interesting. They sort of change the meaning of the scene by scene, yeah. Because it's almost a character.
Okay, so there is not a scene that we have that reveals this, but can we talk a little bit about, Is there a Spike Spiegel abs workout that is coming along with this? Because you get in unbelievable shape for a man, well, let's just say our age.
I'm working on an infomercial right now. $29.99, 5 easy payments.
Yeah, and you can never have to do a sit-up.
Yes. But yes, definitely the physical requirements were challenging, and we had a great team, but you know, my focus was definitely trying to do as much as I could and be visible so that they could use as much of me as they could. But it was the biggest challenge of this role.
Yeah, you feel any pressure because with something like this that has a history, that has a solid fan base, has a guy with incredible abs, who is just a cartoon, right? And then you get cast in this role and you're like, you know, I mean, you've played Sulu, which is an iconic character before with a huge fan base. So how do you approach something like this where you know there's people that are going to be watching every move and say, oh, is this guy legit or not?
Sure. A lot of that is built into any big project. You know, you get excited and you start to feel pressure. And what really relaxed me was every single person I met as I went down the line seemed to be devoted fans of the original anime, and I thought, oh, that we'll be in good stead moving forward. And as long as you start with good intentions, I think you can relax and be free in the knowledge that you're approaching it the right way, and hopefully and then, you know, whether people like it or not, you can't control, but what you can control are your intentions, you know.
Well, when did you want to be an actor? When did this start for you?
I fell into it in college. It's a story that in retrospect sounds unbelievable. Like, am I misremembering this? But I was an English major at college, and I was in a creative writing group. And one of the guys said, I am directing a play, and one of my actors got sick, and you look like you could fit the costume. And and I said, okay,
right,
so I gave it a shot.
For this career.
I was the right size for this career. By the way, the costume was sweater and jeans. So in retrospect, I'm like, what was he talking about?
But so when did you know after that first play? Did you like, I could do this? Did you get cast in a film somewhere?
I didn't know. I got cast in a professional play that they had to use students because they were using our campus theater. So they were required to cast a couple of students, and I got one of the roles. And it was at that point, because it was based on a very famous Asian American novel called The Woman Warrior by Maxine Hong Kingston. And it was then that I actually met Asian American actors in the flesh. And heretofore, I didn't think that there were any professional Asian actors. I think in my mind, I didn't really have a thought about it, but I must have thought that they were waiters and office workers who were, you know, sort of the cast and said, would you like to do this bit role on MASH or something? But I didn't think that there was a profession surrounding it or that it was possible. And this was a whole cast of Asian American actors. And I thought, and they were brilliant and they were amazing and they were making a living doing plays and commercials and parts on film and television. I thought, oh, okay, this looks fun. And they were wonderful people. So I thought, I just want to keep hanging out with you guys.
How do you think the business, the industry has changed today? I mean, from when you started in the business and when you perhaps didn't see that many Asian Americans or you saw them in kind of these supporting roles, these bit parts. I mean, we have Minari and Parasite and Crazy Rich Asians that have kind of elevated the visibility in some ways. But, you know, as an actor, producer, director, kind of behind the scenes and the peers that you talk to, what do you hear?
I think it's really, it is changing. And I really was very pessimistic because when I started, I looked back at the 50 years prior to my arrival and then made a mental graph. And I thought, well, it's likely just going to keep going like this. I don't see an event that would make it do this. But there was an event that made it do that. And I would suggest that there was a lot of technology behind it. We went through the internet revolution and Korea also made a very intentional effort to, as a government, to spread their pop culture throughout the world. And it's worked. And we Asian Americans are also the beneficiaries of that, that visibility. And so there has been a kind of an industrial revolution within the industry of cinema and also the fragmentation of the audience. And the number of outlets available has helped us. So I think there are way more working Asian Americans in the industry than there used to be. And that is a good thing. And I notice an ethos change. You know, when I was younger, I felt like everyone had to be the one, you know, the one. And I think that is thankfully disappearing. And I know that I meet lots of Asian Americans in the business who are actively seeking to collaborate with one another. And that's kind of new.
You're also an author. You wrote a book that's going to be out here in spring. It's aimed at kids called Troublemaker. What's it about?
It's about a kid who comes home on April 29th, 1992, and discovers that his parents are home for some reason and that they're home because there's possible unrest in Los Angeles. And so the father goes to the store, their store in South Central, to board it up. And the boy decides that his father needs protection and sneaks out of the house with a gun in his backpack to deliver it to his father. And it's a story of that night trying to get to his dad.
Why was that moment important for you? What was going on? I mean, you were a little older than the child that you're writing about as a central character, but what did you start thinking about during that time when the whole country was watching what was happening on TV?
Well, what happened was I was set to write a different book altogether. And when the pandemic hit and George Floyd was murdered and we were watching the protests on television, stuck inside our houses, and then the anti-Asian violence started happening and we were trying to discuss these things with our children. So my mind just started thinking about all kinds of things, including the 92 riots, and started to measure things like how much progress have we made, thinking about the Latasha Harlan's murder and all those things, and realizing it's been a long time since that event and thinking about, relatively speaking, how little progress has been made. And so those are the things on my mind. And the idea just sort of came to me to maybe tell this story through a child's lens. And I pitched the idea to my editor and said, I have a completely different book in mind that I'd like to write. And I think maybe I need to get it out of me. Yeah. And so that's where it came from.
So if you don't mind me asking, what kind of questions were your kids struggling with during the pandemic? And what kinds of answers did you and their mom come up with?
I don't know that they were asking so many questions as we were trying to sort of ride this balance between telling the truth, but not have them be scared. And that's that turned out to be a very difficult line to straddle, you know, because we did have to call their grandma and grandpa and say, maybe you shouldn't take a walk for a couple of months, you know, maybe you should curb those walks and maybe you should carry mace and, you know, like things like that. And that's going to frighten the children. And yet we had to know, they had to know what was going on. We had on our street, we had somebody spray painted China below the word stop on the stop sign at the end of our street. So it was very close to us, you know, we didn't have anyone that was beaten or anything, but it started to creep in. And I think the discussion was really, what country are we living in? And I think there may be a battle going on right now to define what America is to some extent. And that's what the book was to me, me reflecting on what this country is and comparing it to what my parents thought they were bringing us to and what I grew up thinking this country was and hoping it still is, you know, because I hope that our institutions are what I thought they were, because I'm very proud to be an American, and I'm so admiring of our institutions and our capacity for improvement, and I hope that long term that is the case. And I just feel like we're in a moment of crisis, trying to kind of figure it all out.
Yeah, I remember at the beginning of the pandemic, you wrote a column, jotted down a sentence from it. It said, the pandemic is reminding us that our belonging is conditional. One moment we are Americans, the next we are all foreigners. Who brought the virus here? Do you think things are better now? I mean, compared to March, April of 20?
I guess a casual survey would suggest yes. I mean, I don't know if the root feelings have changed. That is to say, the virus is in a better place as compared to a year ago. So maybe that anxiety is dissipating a little bit as people are kind of coming out of their homes. I don't know. And I think the history of Asians in America would suggest that when there is a crisis, somebody has to be scapegoated. And it might be us again. You know, I certainly hope that's not the case. And maybe we learned something from this event. But, you know, I've been out of the country for a year. We were in New Zealand shooting this, and I shot another movie there. So I'm trying right now also, I've only been back a couple of weeks, trying to understand what's changed and what the mood of the country is and what's going on. So I'll come back tomorrow and let you know.
Okay, good. Once you catch it all up. You do so many different types of films. Some people watching this and say, oh, it's the guy from Star Trek. And there's a good chunk of people who are going to remember you from the Harold and Kumar movies. And recently, your co-star from those films, Cal Penn, wrote a book in which he said he was engaged to a man. And I wonder if at the time that you were making those films, would it have had an impact had Cal Penn been openly gay then?
Yeah, the pace of social change is dizzying. And during the pandemic, I was just remembering, I was rewatching Friends, you know, comfort food. Yeah. And I was like, wow, there's a lot of gay jokes in this sitcom. And it doesn't seem that long ago. It's a completely modern sitcom.
Yeah.
And yet it was just sort of wall-to-wall gay jokes. You know, I enjoyed it. I didn't notice it then. In terms of Cal's an exceptional performer. He's so lovable. I'd like to think that it wouldn't have mattered. I really do. And I tend to think that the American audience is underestimated. I could be wrong, but I would hope that it would have been the same result.
What are you up to next? I mean, have you guys already gotten a green light for another season of Bebop?
I can't talk about that, but what's up for me next? I'm unemployed currently, so.
So what do you look for now? Let's say your agent or your manager or whoever brings you projects. What's the thing that automatically says to you, this is something I want to sink my teeth into? Because you've done lots of different types of projects.
You know, for me now, if there's any personal philosophy I have in terms of what I'm going to be doing going forward, I think I'm done with the portion of my career where I go, this is a smart move, or this is the strategic. I'm going to stop thinking about strategy or any of those things. I think it's moving forward. If I can, then you might see me doing the ab infomercial. But if I can't, I'd just like to say, this speaks to me. And I don't know. And sometimes you don't know why something speaks to you. Sometimes it's just got you fall in love. And you have to do it. And so I think that's what I'd like to do, and not worry about a career trajectory or money or what's cool or whatever it is. I just would like to do things that speak to me.
John Cho, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And we look forward to seeing where his career takes him next. And finally, capturing the wild at its wackiest, from a fish hamming it up to acrobatic rodents, even an awkward pigeon. Well, this year's winners of the Comedy Wildlife Photography Awards are out, with the top prize going to Ken Jensen for snapping this picture of a very uncomfortable monkey sitting on a bridge wire. I guess it's nice to know that animals, like humans, also have uncomfortable moments, and sometimes they are caught on camera. We hope that monkey is feeling much better now. Well, that is it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thank you so much for watching, and goodbye from New York.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii.
You can now watch CNN's Five Things on Max. Each weekday, Kate Baldwin breaks down the five essential news stories in 5 minutes or less. She'll get you up to speed and on with your day. CNN's Five Things with Kate Baldwin, streaming weekdays exclusively on Max.